America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Well, it's getting weirder and weirder, the situation with Iran. I mean, talk about cross currents and strange disconnects and dysfunctions and whatnot. We mentioned yesterday Condi Rice saying, well, you know, dissent is an okay thing. That was more about Iraq, but, you know, she's been one of the main cheerleaders for the Iran thing, for building up Iran. We now have a third carrier group on its way. The BBC is reporting today shades of the Downing Street memos, the Downing Street minutes. Remember that back in June of 2002, where they said in March or April of 2003, George W. Bush was definitely going to be attacking. And, oh, no, no, we would never do that. I'm the decider. I get to decide. I got no plans to attack. I would never do that. Yeah, right. So anyhow, the Downing Street, so it's interesting how this stuff seems to come out of the UK. The BBC reporting today. Well, here, I'll just read it straight up. U.S. contingency plans for airstrikes on Iran extend beyond nuclear sites and include some of the country's military infrastructure, the BBC has learned. By the way, welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-303-2270. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. You can also get there through AirAmericaRadio.com and just click on our page. U.S. contingency plans for airstrikes on Iran extend beyond nuclear sites. It's understood that any such attack, if ordered, would target Iranian air bases, naval bases, military facilities, and command and control centers. And they say that there's two triggers, two things that can set this off. Now, keep in mind, this is half the story. There's really two halves to this story today that I want to share with you that I think are really worth attending to. This half of the story from BBC, the other half I'm going to share with you in a minute from the Wall Street Journal, and then how we bring this all together with what Bush has done with Posse Comitatus from yesterday, the editorial in yesterday's New York Times, and what I've been raving about for, you know, what, a year or more here now, the loss of habeas corpus in the United States, several years. But in any case, back to Iran, Frank Gardner, BBC security correspondent Frank Gardner, says there are two triggers that could cause the U.S. to launch a massive and devastating aerial attack against Iran. And we are within weeks of being fully prepared, fully in position to do exactly that. He says the trigger for such an attack reportedly includes any confirmation that Iran was developing a nuclear weapon, which it denies. They say, yes, we're enriching uranium because that's what you do if you want to have a nuclear power plant. Now, that, by the way, is going to get to the second half of the story that I'm going to tell you in just a minute, because there really is a whole second half to this story that the Wall Street Journal, oddly enough, is laying out on its front page today about why would it be that Iran wants to have nuclear power. And I say that as somebody who's no fan of nuclear power, but nonetheless, why would Iran want to have nuclear power when they're sitting on, you know, as Dick Cheney is so fond of saying, 10% of the world's oil? So, you know, why? How could that be? And we'll get to that in a minute. So anyhow, the first trigger, if we have any evidence that they're building a nuclear bomb. Well, you know, we've been here before with this. The any evidence thing. Oh, we've got plenty of evidence. We have proof. We have, you know, this is a massive stockpile, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so we've been through that. But then the second trigger, is any sort of attack. From the BBC. Alternatively, our correspondent adds, a high casualty attack on U.S. forces in neighboring Iraq could also trigger a bombing campaign if it were traced directly back to Tehran. Now, we're not going to bomb Saudi Arabia, even though they're raising money there for the Sunni insurgents who have killed the majority of our soldiers. You'll recall it was a Shia mosque that was blown up. We're not going after them. You know, keep in mind, this the language, the wording that's coming out of the administration right now is so similar to late 2002.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Yeah. Now, that's like 5 years ago. 4.5 years ago. So these two triggers, either one of these things could cause us to come, and we knew, by the way, we now know that when he said that, when Bush said that, that he was lying. Not a word that I'm frankly comfortable using in the same sentence with President of the United States, but the Downing Street memo laid it right out. Bush went over to the UK, met with Tony Blair and their defense minister and said, you know, we're going to attack Iraq. We're going to do it in the spring. And here it is, June, July 2002. We need to fit the intelligence to meet the policy. The policy is attack. And the BBC again reporting that we're ready. Now, they're not reporting that the policy is to attack. They're reporting that the policy is to be ready to attack and that either of these two things could be used as a justification. Now, the other half of the story. And this is where it gets, you know, frankly, I think even more interesting. Right on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal, article by Bill Spindle. Iran sits on 1/10 of the world's known oil supplies. Now, by the way, this was similar to what Cheney was saying about Iraq, you'll recall.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of world oil reserves. Very significant reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, now that was Cheney talking about Iraq way back in 2002. So now we're seeing the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Iran sits on 1/10 of the world's oil supplies. But, and here's the but, and this is something that I suspect the vast majority of Americans are totally clueless about. But it is using Iran. I mean, keep in mind, this is a country of 70 million people. It's a large nation. It's not a little third world backwater. I mean, major cities and high rises and industry and business, and it is using so much energy these days it may start rationing gasoline as soon as next month. Now the reason for this pretty simple. You know, Chavez, for example, down in Venezuela, he's talking about price controls. Because inflation is spiraling out of control. It doesn't work. I mean, Nixon tried that. It didn't work here. You can't administer the real marketplace, the prices in the real marketplace by fiat. You can set a lot of rules for the real marketplace. You know, how businesses can behave, how they can treat their employees, you know, the limits on how big they can grow, what industries they can go into. And all of those are entirely appropriate, and I'm totally supportive of them. But you can't set the prices by fiat, by simply saying, do it because I said so. But Iran is doing that with their gasoline. They're keeping gas at 40 cents a gallon. They're subsidizing it. It's so cheap that everybody in Iran has bought a car. People are driving like crazy. I mean, it's a big country. It's 4 or 5 times the size of Iraq. It's huge. With a lot of people. And so they're having to import gasoline. And there's a graph in the Wall Street Journal where they show, you know, exports versus consumption. And their exports are dropping, their consumption is increasing quite substantially. In fact, they say, and this is why they want to have nuclear power. Indeed, says the article in the front page of today's Wall Street Journal, several other Middle Eastern countries, including Egypt, the world's largest oil exporter, Saudi Arabia, are also investigating nuclear energy programs, citing similar reasons. Those reasons being that their own domestic supply of oil is not enough for them and to export and make a living at. So, you know, they think the solution is nuclear. Now, I think that's crazy. I think, you know, gee, they're in the Middle East. They're surrounded by desert. They got lots of sunlight. Their solution should be solar. But, you know, set that argument aside for the moment. They bought this bill of goods in the nuclear power industry. Middle Eastern oil suppliers are now becoming some of the largest consumers of energy anywhere. Iran already consumes more oil than all but 15 other countries on Earth, according to the International Energy Agency. In 1995, Iranians used the equivalent of 34% of the oil they pumped from the ground, exporting the rest. Last year, they used 40%. In Iran's natural gas industry, the pinch has already begun. Although Iran has 15% of the world's gas reserves, the country imported more than it exported in 2005. In January, Iran briefly cut off gas exports to Turkey as the Iranian government struggled with a surge in domestic use during a stretch of cold weather. They couldn't even keep their own people warm. So now, granted, this is the, you know, a whole bunch of dumb government policies and subsidies and things, but the bottom line is they probably really are trying to generate nuclear power. Yeah, but we'd like that oil. You know, we'd really like that oil. 16 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
As a young man, I found politics into Bush's army door. And I got real good at dirty tricks. My name, sir, is Karl Rove. Oh, Dick Cheney, don't you cry for me. Cause when your administration's gone, the right will kiss my knee.
Yes. Good old Karl Rove. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This is really, really quite remarkable, this whole, I mean, the layout of this thing. The energy industry accounts for some 85% of Iran's export income, but oil shipments may be poised to go into a steep decline. Some industry researchers say they can see the day, perhaps 10 years off. This is today's Wall Street Journal, an article by Bhushan Babri. Some say as much as 10 years off, when Iran may have no oil to export unless it dramatically changes the policies affecting its oil industry. In other words, Iran is close to peak oil, if not already there. Meanwhile, domestic gas use is rising so fast, it's at the rate of 11% annually, that Iran must import more processed fuel because its refineries long have been unable to meet demand. Already, Iran is using 1.5 million barrels a day of its own crude production, or close to 4 million barrels a day. So they produce 4 million barrels a day. They're consuming 1.5 just domestically. After peaking at 6 million barrels a day in the 1970s, they're down to 4 million barrels a day now. Many of Iran's, now this is the closing paragraph of this piece. The headline is How Iran is Vulnerable to a Decline in Oil Exports. The closing paragraph, many of Iran's biggest oil fields have been producing for decades and are now in strong natural decline. So Ahmadinejad and the Iranians, they say, you know, we're building nuclear power plants. Why? Because we're running out of oil. Now, again, as I said, I think that they should be building solar power plants or wind power or something. I mean, there's no shortage of alternatives to nuclear, but that's the direction that they've chosen to go. And but there's still a lot of oil there. Khuzestan province in the center of Iran's energy industry already generates 17% of Iran's electricity. But that's not enough to keep electricity flowing in the provincial capital all the time. I mean, they're actually having power blackouts now. And an even bigger problem is the consumers themselves. That's because subsidies make energy practically free in Iran, discouraging any serious energy conservation. And they're talking about gasoline at 40 cents a pump. And the government has spent so far this year, this fiscal year, $7 billion importing gasoline. So, you know, Iran needs to be taking Jimmy Carter's advice. but at the same time, you have the oil industries around the world and you have the Bush administration looking at Iran and going, a lot of oil there. Maybe we should be thinking about that. And remember his big news, Brzezinski, Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, back about, a month ago or so? He was testifying before Congress. It was, as I recall, the last week of January, the first week of February. He was testifying before the United States Senate. And he said, to argue that America is already at war in the region with a wider Islamic threat of which Iran is the epicenter is to promote a self-fulfilling prophecy. And then he warned the senators of what, in his mind, the Bush administration was up to, what they might, you know, where this thing, he called this a plausible scenario for a military collision with Iran. He said a terrorist act blamed on Iran, culminating in a defensive U.S. military action against Iran that plunges a lonely America into a spreading and deepening quagmire, eventually ranging across Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Not a country that actually has nukes. And Pakistan. Now, at the same time, here at home, where people may say, you know, we really don't want a war, thank you very much. We'd rather not have a war. George W. Bush and his Republican, and a few Democrats as well. This is not entirely Republican. Let's say the conservatives in our government. In the dead of night, to paraphrase, perhaps even quote, the New York Times in an editorial yesterday called Making Martial Law Easier, snuck into the military appropriations bill last October. It was in September. It was signed into law in October. Doing away with the Posse Comitatus Act of, as I recall, 1871. Maybe it was 1873. That this was after the Civil War, where we said never again will American soldiers shoot at or use military force against American civilians in America. Never again. We had enough of that in the Civil War. Not going to happen again. And the law that was passed is called the Posse Comitatus Act, which basically says that the military cannot be used against civilians. That was stripped out. Bush did not mention this when he signed the law. Congress, by and large, nobody mentioned this. In fact, it may be that nobody even knew about it. This is a piece of legislation that would go up to your hip if it was printed out. And it changed the Insurrection Act of 1807, which also provided some protections for us. And now the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals just ruled 2-1 that if Bush decides to put you in prison as long as he wants with no access to a lawyer, that's just fine. That's just fine. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Welcome back to the place where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Omar versus Harvey. Have you heard about this? Omar versus Harvey. This is a case that was argued earlier this month. This Azik Hook, writing in The Nation, called Framing the Presidency, is the title of the article. Omar versus Harvey argued earlier this month the president's lawyers made the following claim. When international entanglements are involved, signified in the Omar case by a United Nations Security Council resolution, U.S. officials can detain a U.S. citizen indefinitely. You heard that right. U.S. Everybody says, oh, this is just foreigners. We got nothing to worry about. This is foreigners. No. This guy was a U.S. citizen. Shawky Omar is his name. He was arrested by U.S. personnel at his home in Baghdad in October 2004. He was taken to a U.S. prison in Baghdad, interrogated, and subjected to electric shocks. This is acknowledged by our government. We tortured him. He remains to this day. Now, he was arrested 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago, October 2004. U.S. citizen. Remains in U.S. custody, rotated through a series of prisons in Iraq. There's another U.S. citizen. A prisoner at Camp Cropper in Iraq, a fellow by the name of Mohammed Munaf. He's claiming an unfair trial in connection with his death sentence imposed by an Iraqi court for his role in the kidnapping of three Romanian journalists for whom he was acting as a translator. And in these cases, basically what the president's lawyers said is, these guys don't have access to the U.S. courts. These guys don't have access to due process. These guys don't have access to a trial of a jury of their peers. They don't have the right to make bail. They don't have the right to be faced by their accusers. So all those constitutional protections, even though they are U.S. citizens, we thought it was just Jose Padilla, or Padilla, he wants it to be pronounced now, and Yasser Hamdi. We thought it was just these two guys. No, sorry. Here's a couple more, and we don't know how many others there are. There may be many disappeared Americans. They only seem to come to light when, you know, finally somebody says, hey, wait a minute, what happened to Ralph? So, number one, Iran has an oil crisis. They are running out of oil, 20 to 30 years. Their fields are pumping far less than they were before. They're running out of oil. They're trying to build nuclear power. They have a problem that really we should be helping them with. And I don't know, maybe the Chinese will. Maybe they'll come in and they'll say, well, yeah, we'll provide you with some technology. An energy problem, an energy crisis. Because of, frankly, dumb government policies of subsidizing energy. Much like, by the way, I would say we subsidize oil here in the United States. The actual cost of oil, when you include the cost of defending the transportation of oil from all over the world into the United States, which is not built into the cost of a gallon of gas. The cost of the Sixth Fleet, you know, is making sure that the transport from the Middle East to here is safe. That you and I pay for that with our taxes, not at the gas pump. But when you add that in, plus, you know, then what you have is that the real cost of a gallon of gasoline is around $6 a gallon. And then when you add in the cost of all the cancers that are caused by burning fossil fuels, it's around $10 a gallon. That's the true cost of gasoline in the United States. And the Europeans have known this for a long time. It's why gas has been $5, $6, $7 a gallon in most European countries for decades. And what do? They conserve. Well, the Iranians need to learn to conserve as well. But that doesn't mean that we need to bomb them back to the Stone Age. I mean, this is just amazing. So here we have the president on the one hand saying anybody who dissents or anybody he doesn't like, he can throw them in jail forever. And they don't have rights as U.S. citizens, even though they are U.S. citizens. Because, quote, an international entanglement is involved, end quote. Now, this case, by the way, was rejected by the U.S. District Court of Appeals, the Omar versus Harvey case. But the administration, in all probability, is going to appeal it to the Supreme Court, where Scalia and Roberts and Alito and Thomas, I'm sure, are just, you know, oh boy. And at the same time, again today, this breaking Guantanamo detainees, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, there's this court-stripping provision. You've heard of court-stripping? Court-stripping is where the Military Commissions Act basically says you don't have the right to go to have an appeal to the courts. Sorry. You're stuck in front of a military commission, and that's it. Military commissions, by the way, the history of military commissions is pretty amazing. It was back in the U.S. war against Mexico. I think it was 1848, wasn't it? Something like that. In any case, there was a colonel who took Mexico City. And at that time, there was no law. If a conquering army took a city, they could do anything they damn well pleased. You know, rob, rape, and pillage. I mean, that was what happened. And this guy said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to set up a court system. Obviously, it's not going to be a civilian court system because there are no civilian structures right now. We just seized this country. The government doesn't exist. So we'll create military commissions, under which he prosecuted his own soldiers for misbehaving against civilians. His own soldiers. And so now we're seeing military commissions, which we invented for all practical purposes to promote the rule of law, being absolutely twisted around in the other direction. It's mind-boggling. John in Denver, Colorado. Hey, John, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today? John? No John. Okay. Let's go to Virginia in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Virginia, welcome to the program. I'm not here in Virginia either. So I'm going to put Virginia on hold, and I'm going to go back to talking about this stuff just a little bit more while Andrew figures out what's going on with our board. So making martial law easier. These new presidential powers, this is what the New York Times said about all of these presidential powers, all this stuff that's going on. It said these new presidential powers were slipped into law without hearings or public debate. The president made no mention of the changes. What we're talking about here is the doing away with posse comitatus. The president made no mention of the changes when he signed the measure, and neither the White House nor Congress consulted in advance with the nation's governors. So what are we going to do about this? What can we do about this? Well, actually, Pat Leahy, who's the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Democrat from Vermont, Senator, Pat Leahy and Chris Bond, the Republican senator from Missouri, have put together a piece of legislation which is backed unanimously by the nation's governors. You get this? I mean, you know, people call up and they're like in despair. You know, what are we going to do? Bush has taken so much power. Yes, he has. And we'll never be able to stop it. Yes, we will. Yes, there are parallels between what's going on now and what happened, for example, in Germany in the 1930s, or what happened in Spain in the 1920s, or what happened in Italy in the late 20s and early 30s. Yes, there are parallels. Sure. And Germany did not have a 200-year history of the rule of law and democracy. They had a multi-hundred-year, maybe a thousand-year history. I'm not all that conversant in German history pre-1800, but for hundreds and hundreds of years, at the very least, they had the rule of kings. And the German people, they'd had democracy for, 10, 15 years, something like that, and Hitler comes along and says, I'll be your new king, basically. Ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer, yeah? I'll be the new king of the people, of the country. And the German people were, that's cool. That's normal for us. Not normal in the United States. Sorry. Not normal in the United States. And so when Bush comes along with his strange little sayings,
If it were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
these kinds of things. I'm sorry. It's just, here in America, we don't buy it. We don't buy that war is peace.
When we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
It's just not part of the American experience. We actually believe that peace is a positive and active force. That peace is a normal and stable state. And so here we have these two pieces of legislation, two very, very significant pieces of legislation that were passed just in the last few months. And in my opinion, we need to be doing everything we can to repeal them. One is these riders that were attached to the military appropriations bill to do away with posse comitatus and the Insurrection Act of 1808 that allow George Bush to nationalize a state's National Guard and use those military. And he probably used them in other cities, right? He probably, if he's going to go into Texas, he probably wouldn't use the Texas National Guard. He'd probably use the Massachusetts National Guard because he's federalized them, and people are less likely to shoot at their neighbors. And unanimously, the governors of the United States are opposed to this. They're all saying, no, we don't, this is not a good plan. And at the same time, he's before the court. And then at the same time, you've got Alberto Gonzalez going before Congress last week saying, oh, there's no right to habeas corpus. We haven't even gotten into habeas corpus. But all of this now is being stirred at the same time that these guys, according to the BBC, are fixing to have a war in Iran, and Iran's running out of oil. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Thank you. horses to pasture, they'd feed them on hay. Even machines get retired someday. The boss gets a pension when he is too old. You helped him retire, you're out of the cold. And you're too old to work. Too old to work when you're too old to work. And you're too young to die. Who will take care of you? How you get by when you're too old to work and you're too young to die?
Well, see, in most advanced societies around the world, we say, you know, we're gonna work this out. That if you put in your productive years working hard to help build society and raise a family and be a good citizen, that we, the people collectively, we're going to make sure you don't, you know, live in poverty. But that's not quite the idea of the conservatives here in the United States. Let's try the phone lines again here and see if Andrew has done his magic on the board. Virginia in Seattle, Washington. Virginia, good morning.
Yes. Are
hey,
you there?
I am. Are you there?
Okay.
Okay, it's working.
I wonder sometimes.
Yeah, Andrew, you're a genius.
Well, I was hoping that maybe we could find some way to export environmental technology to these countries that are thinking about nuclear power.
Yeah, this is what we should be doing. We should be saying to Iran, you guys want to build nuclear power plants because you think that you have, you know, you have an it's not that they think, they have an electricity crisis. I mean, they've got cities that literally have brownouts because they don't have enough electricity. And they don't have enough oil to fuel it. And so why don't we say to them, listen, we'll help you out. We'll help you out developing solar power.
Yes.
I mean, it's not like there's a lack of sunshine in the Middle East.
Yes, wind.
Yeah, yeah. It's absolutely crazy. So anyway, thank you very much, Virginia, for plugging that in. Well said. Charlie in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Tom. You know, you were mentioning it's only happening to Arabs, you know, that people say, it's just the detainees. It reminded me of that Niemöller quote that the posters used to be on. First,
yeah.
Hitler came for the Jews, and then after a while, when he came for me, there was nobody left.
Yeah. Actually, it starts out, I think, first they came for the trade unionists, Well, whatever it was.
I think it was Jews, Catholics, unions, and industrialists.
Yeah, there you go.
Anyway, the role of the press in not reporting this stuff is really... I saw a quote from Abraham Lincoln, 1860, Cooper Square here in New York. He said, it's an easy step from restraining the press to making it place the worst actions of government in so favorable a light that we groan under tyranny and oppression without knowing from whence it came. And it seems to me we're at sort of a tipping point like this now where we can wake up one day and just not realize how it happened, but our freedoms are gone.
Yeah, well, and in fact they are. I mean, if Gonzalez is right and if the Supreme Court upholds these things, they are gone. Unless Congress takes action, and you're just spot on right, Charlie, and that's why it's so important that we get Congress out there doing something, and that we make our voices heard to our elected representatives. Scott, Nebraska. Hey, thanks for the call, Charlie. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind today?
Oh, good. I called in because I heard you talking earlier about the indefinite detaining of U.S. citizens.
Yes.
And I guess I am just floored. You know, I remember when Clinton was in office, and how the deliverance wing of the Republican Party just went berserk about Elian Gonzalez and the, you know, jackbooted government thugs and
right.
that type of thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of that, you know, is kind of the kooky fringe, one world government types and whatnot. But there really was just this sense of wanting to defend liberties and that type of thing. And really the only consistent one who's been critical of Bush has been Bob Barr.
Yeah. Well, there have been a few others. I mean, you've got Ron Paul out there. I mean, there have been a number of Republicans who have stood up and spoken out, and God bless them. And this is why this is why I say to people who are of the Republican persuasion, please take back your party. You know, show up at the party meetings, get involved, because that party has been taken over by crazies, and it needs to be taken back. It's an important American political party.
Well, it really has, and I guess, you know, south of me here in Kansas, there's been an interesting war between the moderates and the religious wing of it, and the moderates have kind of got the upper hand as of late, which is good. But, you know, I'm just floored that, you know, anyone would rationally believe or argue that U.S. citizens should indefinitely be held without trial. I mean, wasn't that a reason for the Revolutionary War?
In large part, it was, Scott. Actually, I'd say that, you know, the initial reason, the Boston Tea Party, was that it was the first multinational corporation. It was like the first WTO Seattle protest. But yeah, a good chunk of it. And that's why, you know, that's why we enshrine those things into the Bill of Rights, into the Constitution. Scott, spot on. Well said. Thank you very much. Frank in Middletown, New York, listening on WWRL. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today?
I'm glad to have you on the air.
Thank you.
My concern is that the media, both electronic and print, seems more interested in pandering than informing. Example, last Sunday's New York Daily News had four pages on Britney Spears cutting her hair off and a quarter of a page on the Senate blocking the Iraq vote.
Right.
There's something.
Yeah, what's wrong
with
this
picture? I don't know whether I'm more scared of the fact that Daily News and other media seems to think that's what the public cares about, but they may be right. And if they're right, we're in big trouble.
Well, you know, there's always going to be a chunk of the populace who doesn't care about politics. You know, they just want to live their lives.
But I remember I came out of, I'm 67 years old, and I grew up working for the Daily News and later in radio and television and cable news. And back in those days, the old days, most reporters were the poor guys. They were part of that struggling class, and they
sure
cared about things. Now everybody makes $100,000 to a couple million a year, and I think they've lost total connect with what's really happening out there in the real world.
Yeah, I think it's true. I did news in Michigan for 7 years, and it started at like $4 an hour. So,
yeah, exactly.
It was in the 1970s.
Yeah, now you've got guys, you know, and wonderfully coiffed young ladies on CNN and MSNBC and whomever, and God bless them. But, you know,
but it's the star syndrome.
And doing their 3 hours and running off to Ladone for lunch.
Yeah, it's the star syndrome. You're right. And news shouldn't be about being stars. It should be about what the news is. And frankly, I don't think CNN is as guilty of that as the big networks are.
Well, no, I agree, but it just scares me that nobody is paying any attention anymore.
Yeah, well, you are, and I am, and our listeners are, and I think that, frankly, I think, Charlie, that Americans are waking up, and I think it's a good thing. I'm just seeing this all across the country. People waking up saying, you know, to paraphrase, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And we are going to take this country back, and we are going to turn it back to a Democratic Republic. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Yes, those conservative weapons of mass deception. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Abraham Lincoln, I am not bound to win, but I am bound to be true. I am not bound to succeed, but I am bound to live by the light that I have. I must stand with anybody who stands right and stand with him while he is right and part with him when he goes wrong. Nice, Abe Lincoln. J.B. Williams is with us. He's a conservative political columnist and founder of www.jb-williams.com. J.B., welcome to the program. Yep, maybe not. No, he's not up. Lauren is, he's not, he's vanished. Okay, all righty. We will, we'll go along without JB, I guess, for the moment. In fact, let's just continue. We have a board full of callers here. Let's just continue with the topic that we were talking about. I think that's a good one. John, listening on KGZN. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for your efforts. Appreciate you. And thanks, JB, for ceding his time to me.
There we go.
Hey, maybe it's me, but do you ever get the feeling like you're right in the middle of a really bad Fellini film and you can't change the channels? I mean,
you know, there were moments during the Vietnam War when I felt that way, and there have been moments in the last 6 years when I felt that way, and things do change. I mean, the democracy is in our DNA. You know, John, it is so much a part of us. And the unwillingness to submit to tyranny of any sort, whether it's corporate tyranny or whether it's military tyranny or whether it's the tyranny of a president who thinks that he doesn't have to abide by the rule of law, is, I think it's just burned into our genes.
Oh, I do too, and but it kind of amazes me that it doesn't seem as evident as it once did. At least when I grew up, I don't know.
Well,
but,
you know, to some extent, that's true, and it's because of our educational system. When Ronald Reagan became president, I mean, that was the beginning of the conservative revolution, the swing back to the right. We had swung to the right in 1907 after Teddy Roosevelt left, and we swung to the left in 1932 when Franklin Roosevelt came in because of the Republican Great Depression.
Right.
And we were basically a progressive country from 1932 until 1980. Even, I mean, you had good, I would argue that even at his worst, Nixon and Eisenhower, who, you know, Nixon was vice president to, were, relatively speaking, at least consistent, congruent, by and large, with American values. And arguably, in some cases, I mean, you know, Eisenhower was all in favor of a top 90% tax bracket. You know, it's a progressive taxation, for example. He was a big fan of the commons, of the common good. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'd say that those guys were at least, you know, semi-progressive. America was America, you know. And Reagan comes along in 1980 and says, no, we're going to flip this country into this right-wing, you know, what, you know, now in retrospect is moving in the direction of a right-wing hellhole, but, you know, they thought it was going to be a right-wing paradise, you know, where the rich get richer and everybody else, you know, the rising tide will lift all boats and all this kind of stuff. And, in fact, what Reagan did was he set up the destruction of America. And people are figuring this out. We've seen now 26 years of insane economic policies, insane trade policies, and the consequence of it has been that the American middle class is being wiped out. Our industrial base has been wiped out. The whole idea of having a national industrial policy, you know, has gone away. I mean, all these things, and people are starting to say enough is enough already.
Yeah, I think the pendulum is swinging again.
Yeah.
My question to you is, because I really respect your knowledge of the workings of our government.
Right.
Twofold, actually. One, is there any way that there could be, you know, that this Congress could bully through like a 2-year moratorium on presidential pardons, so that we could save some face with the world?
No, there's no way they can do it. It's in the Constitution.
Yeah. Okay, but then the other one being is, you know, just briefly, on September 11th, I'm just a blue-collar carpenter, right? I'm not a political analyst, but I was paying attention. And on September 11th, the instant that second plane hit the buildings, and it was clear that it wasn't an accident, I looked over at my neighbor who I was having coffee with, a right-wing fellow, and I said, well, okay, now they have their excuse. They've got the Reichstag. They're going into Iraq. It might have nothing to do with this, but they're going to do it. Yeah. And then their next stop will be Iran. Now, I'm just a simple guy, and I saw that. And everybody seems to be, I mean.
And Richard Clark says everybody in the White House, you know, that was what Dick Cheney said to everybody in the White House the next day on 9/12.
Well, exactly, and that was out there, but it doesn't even get mentioned. But
right.
My question is, I'm not disrespectful of this Congress. I'm really actually quite impressed that in 100 hours they were able to show that they could get more people's business done than these knuckleheads have had in years. However, isn't there more that can be done to stop this Iran thing? Because this one won't go by quite as unnoticed as Iraq has.
It is, you know, I would say, you know, a few weeks ago or a month ago or maybe even before the elections, I was feeling a certain sense of inevitability about it. But now I think that the Congress is starting to push back and starting to push back aggressively.
And a little too late, maybe?
You know, time will tell. It's going to be almost impossible, frankly, for them to push back if one of our, you know, we position these carrier groups in the Gulf and one of them gets shot at, for example.
Just like they did in the Gulf of Tonkin.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's going to be damn hard. But if they can get some sort of piece of legislation that says before it goes any farther, there has to be explicit and specific action by Congress before Bush can go into Iran, that would be a great start. And there's several pieces of legislation that would do that have been introduced into both the House and the Senate. And we just need to be contacting our elected representatives and saying, listen, we the people don't want any more wars. Thank you very much. We've had enough. And it's time to move on. John, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Raymond in Plattsburgh, New York, listening on WTWK. Hey, Raymond, what's on your mind?
Well, Tom, I'm going to have to take you back a little bit to when you were mentioning the first military commissions being set up in the Mexican-American War. Winfield Scott was the general.
Winfield Scott, right. Yeah.
But in that war, there were a number of great Americans who came out. Robert E. Lee, Zachary Taylor, Ulysses S. Grant, mm-hmm. A number of fine presidents.
Yes. Arguably.
And, well, yes, but there seems to be a thread now, I want to throw it in, that seems to have been those who served the country and then came in. I just kind of find it curious that here we have Britain, the Prince Harry is now going to Iraq.
That's right, although Barbara and Jenna definitely are not.
No kidding. And considering what Senator Webb went through,
yes,
quite the counterpoint.
Yeah, getting dissed for his son being there. Yeah, a good point that you make, Raymond.
And we're in an undeclared war.
Yeah, and Bush's soundbite, in the news, his soundbite today is, if America's at war, and we definitely are at war, and I'm sorry, George, but you already won that war. I mean, it's pretty straightforward, actually. When Bush stood up on the USS Abraham Lincoln and said,
my fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
When he said that, he was right. That was in May of 2003, and we did win that invasion. Now, it was an illegal invasion in my mind, but we won it. We went in, we took down the government, we took the government buildings, we took the institutions, we took down their army, we destroyed all of their military potential, we seized their, or they went into hiding, either arrested or they went into hiding, the entire civilian infrastructure of the government. We won the war. With regard to Iraq, the war is over. What began the next day was the occupation. And funny thing, most people don't like their countries being occupied unless you're really aggressively helping them out when they really need it, like Germany and Japan after World War II, the Marshall Plan kind of thing. But by and large, most countries just don't like being occupied. And it is just, no difference with the Iraqis. The Iraqis are saying, thanks, but no thanks. Randy in Iowa. Hey, Randy, we got half a minute here before we've got to take a break, but something quick.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I wanted to interject that I think privatization is the large picture. When you look at manipulation of Bill of Rights, Constitution, and protected freedoms in the United States, if you look back at the Anaconda Mine situation where Frank Hill was killed by private hired deal, and if you look back at
you can take this all the way back into the mid 1800s, them using private agencies to basically blow apart human rights. Yeah, absolutely spot on, and it works hand in glove. The whole thing of, let's privatize the military. So now you have 100,000, possibly as many as 100,000, quote, soldiers in Iraq who are not soldiers. Who are they answerable to? Nobody. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 17 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. Jeff in San Francisco, California, listening on the Quake. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thank you. One of the major operations of this administration has been to work through our civil rights kind of one by one, or handful by handful. I'm concerned at how it is that they could willingly relinquish power in 08.
Well, it's a good question, and I don't think that Bush is going to want to or easily do that. Frankly, I think that, this was my prediction for the 06 election, was that they were going to rig the thing because they were afraid of the prosecutions that would come. I was wrong. And others, Mark Crispin Miller, a good friend of mine, he and I did this thing here in New York City for Book TV at Vox Pop a while, you know, just before the elections, and we both spoke at the World Can't Wait thing here in New York. And our message was, odds are, you know, it's going to be a rigged election. The Republicans are going to steal it because they can't afford to have Congress actually investigate what these guys are doing. And it turned out that the Democrats won. I mean, I still think that some of the elections were rigged, and, you know, there's massive evidence of it. But nonetheless, there was such a groundswell that they had to back down. They had to say, okay, you know, it's right. I mean, there's still that one race in Florida. But I really think that there is a Democratic foundation, small d Democratic foundation, in the American psyche, and that, you know, just like in 1800, John Adams, they referred to the election of Thomas Jefferson in 1800 to replace Adams as the Revolution of 1800, because a lot of people believed that Adams was going to refuse to leave the White House, and that it was going to create the first constitutional crisis. Adams was our first conservative president. Jefferson was our first overtly liberal president. George Washington was sort of kind of halfway in between, more liberal than conservative. But Adams, I mean, you know, with his Alien Sedition Acts of 1798 was far worse than the Patriot Act or anything we've seen. I mean, he was actually throwing newspaper publishers in jail for criticizing him personally. He threw Ben Franklin's grandson, Benjamin Franklin Bach, in jail for saying that he was, quote, old, toothless, querulous, and balding, end quote. I mean, that was the crime that Ben Franklin Bach committed. So, you know, that it happened. I mean, you know, we said we stepped back from that brink in 1800, and I frankly think we're going to step back from that brink again in 2008. However, it just like in 1800, it's not going to happen if the vast majority of we the people just sit back and say, or my only civic duty is to vote. We have to get engaged. We have to get out there and get active. But Jeff, I'm an optimist. Even in the face of arguably evidence to the contrary. So we'll see. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Philip in San Diego, California. Hey, Philip.
Hi, Tom. All last week I've been writing about the 2002 resolution,
mm-hmm.
which gave a clear reading of it says that it gave Bush the authority to use force against a threat from Iraq, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and if he didn't deal with weapons inspectors, he could use force to deal with that.
Right.
You're absolutely right when you brought up the mission accomplished statement he made on May 1st, 2000.
Well, and not only that, if you go back and you read the resolution that everybody's apologizing for having voted for, it said that if military actions commence against Iraq, that George Bush had to certify in writing to Congress that Iraq represented not only a threat to the United States, but that there was an association with Al-Qaeda which had attacked us on 9/11. And Bush wrote a letter to Congress right after he invaded Iraq in April of 2003 saying that there was an association with Al-Qaeda between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda and that Saddam Hussein was therefore implicitly involved in the 9/11 attacks. And that was false on its face, and he knew it at the time. And in my opinion, that in and of itself is an impeachable offense.
Absolutely. And it amazes me that the House spent a week last week debating a non-binding resolution when there are resolutions out there like H.R. 413 by Congressman Sam Farr out there, which just is a very simple resolution that revokes the 2002 authorization he has and demands a timetable for withdrawal from the troops.
Yeah.
Now, that's been pushed to the wayside. And meanwhile, we're talking about, like today, for instance, the talking points that people are talking about is Barack Obama black enough? You know?
I know. It's politics.
It's driving me nuts. And it makes me feel like, you know, I went out during the November elections and worked hard here in our district to make sure we got the Democrats in power in Congress.
Yeah.
I love what they did the first 100 hours, but now I feel like I'm being let down.
Hey, there's 52 investigations going on of the Republicans right now. They're getting almost no play at all in the press. The corporate mainstream press does not want to talk about them, but there are serious investigations going on, and I think these guys are going to get nailed. I really do think that they're going to get nailed. And the whole thing about, you know, is Barack Obama black enough and these peripheral, it's really what it is it's politics as sports. And it's one of the reasons that I frankly don't talk about that stuff on this program, because I'd rather talk about the issues. I think politics should be about the issues. How is it going to affect we the people? And it's not about the characters. It's about us. It's about all of us getting involved and getting active. And so, you know, occasionally we'll have a sports commentator on to talk about those things, but by and large not. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Mr. President, hey, how about the working man? Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program, 34 minutes past the hour, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, just click live chat up at the top. You can also get there by going to airamericaradio.com and clicking on the Tom Hartman Program page. And Patrick in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Patrick. Listening on KT.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
KPTK. Hey, I'm great, Patrick. What's up?
Oh, I just thought of something here, because since you mentioned that people are starting to get what's going on here about our government. But the one thing that's concerning me is there's a segment of society where people just don't understand it. But it's our youth. I mean, they just don't take the time to vote or register.
Yeah, it's actually there is a growing movement among young people in the United States to both vote and register. And some of the most actually encouraging, to my mind, things coming out, things like in Oregon, the bus project, these are being replicated all around the country. A lot of the Democracy for America stuff, it's frankly the group that I'm seeing not show up at meetings are the group in their mid-30s to mid-40s or maybe even late 40s. The folks who are still out there, you know, working their butts off trying to make a living, you know, as their kids are hitting high school and it's all about economic issues and they don't have the time for politics. And, you know, I have some empathy for that. I went through that myself but your point that our young people are not informed. Yes, absolutely. We need to get on it more. And Patrick, thank you for making that point. The big thing is, I started to mention this, in fact, I think it was in the last hour to a caller and then went off on a tangent, was what we're seeing right now in our colleges with David Horowitz, I think his name is, the guy who's running the campaign against liberal professors. We've got to get rid of these liberal professors. That campaign is the recent version of a campaign that was started during the Reagan administration against liberal teachers in high school. Those of you old enough to remember will remember in the 1980s there was this whole, you know, it was the liberal media and the liberal unionized teachers. How dare these people? We have unionized teachers in our schools. Can you believe it? These people actually belong to unions. And there was and as a consequence of this, the assumption was that because they belong to unions, the teachers, that they must be teaching communism or socialism or unionism or something like that to our young people. And there was a real move to the right in civics teaching in the curriculum in our schools in the 1980s. And we pretty much stopped teaching American history in a meaningful way. We stopped teaching American history in the context of what were the arguments of the time, what were the positions of the time, and instead shifted it over to memorizing dates. And, you know, if you can memorize the first three lines of the Gettysburg Address and you know which, you know, when did the Civil War begin and end and when was the Constitution ratified, if you can memorize those things, then that's fine. You're no child left behind. And we stopped teaching civics. And so we have a whole generation of people who went to school in the 80s, the 90s, and now, and I'm talking about junior high school and high school, middle school and high school, who don't really get it. The stuff that for 200 years we taught in this country about the core values and the basis of this country. And then you get these right-wing talk show hosts like, Neil Bortz, syndicated by Jones Radio, on with Hannity, you know, Fox, talking about the teachers union. They're ruining our school system, says Sean Hannity. And Bort says, okay, they could bring in a nuke in this country and kill 100,000 people. Okay, we could recover from that. It'd be a terrible tragedy. But the teachers' union in this country could destroy a generation. I mean, you get it? A union? How dare they? It's all about taking down the working. It's ultimately about economics. It's always about economics. It's all about taking down the working class in America. The entire conservative and libertarian agenda is about economics. It's about taking us back to the world of Dickens and Marley Scrooge and Marley and that Dickens wrote about in so many of his books. Where Bob Cratchit, please, Mr. Scrooge, my fingers are cold. May I have a lump of coal? No, you may not. It'll cost an extra pence of profit. Well, how about health care for my son, Tiny Tim? No, you can't have it. Are you kidding? I'd have to pay for it. And Scrooge was the middle class. I mean, that's what's normal. What people don't get is that a middle class is not a normal thing. A middle class has to be created by government intervention in the marketplace, as Franklin Roosevelt did by 1935 by signing the Wagner Act and the National Labor Relations Act, making it legal for there to be unions, by creating Social Security. He created a middle class in this country. What is normal is to have a very small number of people who own less than 1% who own more than 90% of the wealth. And this is, look at 7,000 years of history. This is what you see. To have a very small ruling elite, an oligarchy for all practical purposes. We used to call them kings and queens. Number one. Number two, to have a small middle class of the experts, the mercantilists, the physicians, the people who are such experts that they're actually able to form something like a union, like the stonemasons. And then to have a very large class of the working poor, well over 90% of the population. And that's what Charles Dickens wrote about in every one of his books. He saw it because his own father went to debtor's prison. And that's the conservative and libertarian view for America, is just turn it over to the big corporations and let them run everything. And the problem is, when that happens, the middle class stands up and says, hey, wait a minute. We don't like this at all. We'd like to have a middle class in America. And you have the middle class protesting. And then the conservatives say, oh, well, this is social instability. We can't have social instability. These people are misusing their rights. To quote J. Edgar Hoover from, during the McCarthy era. Misusing their rights. Therefore, they shouldn't have their rights. Which brings us all back to George Bush arguing in court, or the Bush administration arguing in court, that Americans, four of them now that we know of, that Americans should be able to be held indefinitely. And you think that isn't a challenge to the United States that is worse than anything any teachers union could ever come up with? Come on. Gene in Napa, California, listening on the Quake. Hey, Gene, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi, Tom. I was really enjoying your show today and always do. I call because there's a documentary series on PBS called The Supreme Court, and I've learned a lot from it. But overall, I thought it was obviously considerably biased to the right. For instance, you mentioned the Adams Aliens and Sedition Act today.
Right.
They mentioned it, but only by name. They didn't go into the how people suffered.
It's like McCullough's history of John Adams. I mean, everybody's trying to whitewash John Adams because he was the first president to have his son also be president. He was the first conservative president. The Alien Sedition Act so tarnished his reputation that nobody even wanted to mention him for 100 years. And now they're trying to rehabilitate him.
Yeah, and this is what this show was doing, too. It just glossed right over that. Yeah. And then when it closed, it had this embracing, prolonged, very sentimental conclusion centered around this deceased Rehnquist,
right.
Justice Rehnquist.
Yeah, who had fought in Arizona to prevent blacks from voting. I mean,
right.
Rehnquist, he had a very keen legal mind. I have tremendous respect for Rehnquist's legal mind, but I disagree with him on a lot of issues. Not all, oddly enough. I mean, he in his dissent in the First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti case, in his dissent in that case, he said that in 1886, the Supreme Court, without benefit of public argument or debate, ruled that corporations are entitled to the rights of persons in this country, and then goes on to talk about how he thinks that was wrong. Well, in fact, the court never ruled that, but that's the mythology. So, there's some areas where Rehnquist got it right, but by and large, you're right. He was a right-wing crank, and I'm not surprised that, PBS is now, they've stacking the head, the corporation with public broadcasting with Republicans, so it's now Republican public broadcasting, or what can you say? You know, I'm somebody who believes that we need a strong public broadcasting system. Every country should have, but you know, it's the cons of trying to take that apart too. Ray in Ardsley, New York, listening on WRL. Hey, Ray.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm fine. What's up?
Yeah, I have a lot of respect for you, but one thing I think we definitely need to talk about more is a critique of the U.S. empire, and just focusing on a few of the things Eisenhower did, which really can be described only as international terrorism, was overthrowing democracy in Iran in 1953 and overthrowing a democracy in Guatemala in 1954, which basically led to a massive genocide. And to this day, the president of the National Assembly in Guatemala was a general who was involved with the massacre of 200,000 Mayan peasants in the 1980s.
You're absolutely right, Ray, and you can go all the way back to the Spanish-American War. I mean, there's in American adventures overseas we were doing
adventures. Though I mean, this is genocide.
Well, I don't disagree with you, but
and in 1954, Eisenhower prevented a national election to take place in Vietnam. There's a memo, government memo document from then that they knew Ho Chi Minh would get 90% of the vote. They prevented this election, and you know, 20.
Yeah, this was after the French pulled out.
Right. Sure. Well, after the French were forced out, and the United States supported the French. Yeah.
No, I'm not disagreeing with you, Ray. There are some very dark and awful periods in American history, and I'm certainly not deifying Dwight Eisenhower. But the point is that we need to reclaim the best of our values. And, you know, sitting around and hitting ourselves over the head with a stick and saying, oh, how terrible am I, is not going to be anywhere near as productive as looking at the best of our values and moving forward from there. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
The Union busting and watch our plants rusting while our talk shift overseas. 60,000 workers that we buried last year found the cost of doing business too high. We just come to work here. We don't come to die.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria Jones with TalkRadioNews.com on the air, on the line. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, a number of different things. We've got the closing arguments in the Scooter Libby trial going on.
Mm-hmm.
They've broken for lunch, so they're not arguing at the moment. But we have had Peter Zeidenberg, who's arguing for the prosecution, making the point that, look, this guy is desperately trying to discredit the husband of Valerie Plame, and it's really not credible to think that he would forget all the information about the wife. In fact, he used the words, it's ludicrous.
Right. Now, do you think that there's a sense on the part of some of the, you know, of the defense that, you know, it doesn't really matter what we do because Bush is going to pardon him anyway?
I think there's a sense of that. I think there's also a sense that he may be acquitted.
Really?
I think there is a sense that he may be acquitted, yes.
Why?
Because I think that the feeling is that this is quite difficult to prove in a way, because they were able to show that each of the prosecution witnesses had flaws and lapses in their memory.
Hmm.
And so they were able to show, look,
so there's
everyone makes mistakes.
Sure. So you have this long string of witnesses who are all saying essentially the same thing, but each one of them was impeached to some extent.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Exactly. So that is the flaw in the prosecution's case. Now, you've also got a very interesting jury. You've got a jury with two PhDs, a jury with higher than usual education levels, a jury that was allowed to make extensive notes, and a jury that was allowed to ask questions. Very few judges allow this, but this judge does.
Yeah.
And they were allowed to ask questions. So
I believe the law requires it.
But a lot of judges just say, can't do it.
Right.
But this judge did. So you've got a very intriguing scenario.
Yeah. Interesting. So when's this going to all wrap up?
It should wrap up at the end of today.
Oh, really?
Yes. We've got 3 hours to listen to Mr. Wells, the defense attorney, and then the rebuttal will happen by the prosecution, and then it'll all be over, and then off they go to deliberate, and we have no idea how long they're going to take.
Right.
We never do.
Yeah, which is, you know, welcome to the jury system.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
Interesting. Now, there are 52 is the last count that I've seen. Separate investigations going on.
You love counting them.
Of crimes in the Bush administration. You know, Congress is actually conducting
crimes in the Bush administration.
Yeah, alleged. Thank you. Is actually, you know, conducting hearings. They're actually holding hearings and they're starting investigations and they're doing these things. Virtually none of these are reported in the mainstream media, and I'm just curious: A, why, and B, what in your mind are the investigations that are ongoing that have the greatest promise to bear some fruit?
I think the reason why is the same reason, and it's a prosaic one, it's the same reason why most committee hearings are not reported on, because they're just dull.
Yeah, it's sort of like news coverage on dry and cement.
Exactly. They just don't get reported on, and it's as simple as that. I mean, if you've got Henry Waxman up there chairing something and thumping the table, then you're going to get a little bit of coverage.
Right.
And, you know, you've got the Senate X, Y, and Z committee, and you've got four presidential candidates on the committee, you're going to get some coverage.
But see, Waxman was doing that. I mean, he was looking into what was going on with the contractors. He was clearly defining fraud. He was accusing companies of fraud, and it was a story that lasted in the news cycle probably 5 hours.
Right, but it was great stuff while it lasted, and I'm amazed that it lasted that long, quite honestly, because it had to do with money.
Yeah.
It wasn't even that exciting, but
yeah, it had nothing to do with Britney Spears shaving her head.
It didn't, which I am absolutely fascinated by.
Yes, of course we all are. We all want to know. Was it because of lice?
I don't know.
That's as weird as I'm going to get. I'm sorry. We'll stop right there.
It's just way weird.
Yeah, it's so. These investigations are, and Congress is off this week.
Congress is off this week. There are a couple of hearings going on. There's one going on up in Fargo, North Dakota. That must be lovely. Mm-hmm. And there's one going on up in Alaska. Why they don't pick Miami for these hearings if they're going to have hearings in January, I don't know. But
usually it's a member of Congress holding them in their home district so that they get the local PR bennies out of it. Right?
Yeah, they can show off.
Yeah, it's.
But it's very quiet in Washington, so a lot of attention is being paid to the Libby trial. The president's around. He's doing things, although he is traveling tomorrow and Thursday. But really, the attention, I have to say, in the White House press briefing today was on a couple of things. Part of it was on Iran, because Iran made the very helpful statement today that it would stop doing enrichment if everybody else stopped doing enrichment, which did get the kind of yawn that you would expect from this and every other administration.
Well, on the other hand, though, Victoria, the BBC is reporting today that the administration has decided that one of two triggers could cause a massive and devastating attack of Iran, and not just their military, you know, the obvious military, not just their nuclear facilities, but their entire military infrastructure. And you know, one of those triggers would be if there was an act of terrorism around the world, one of those triggers would be if it could be demonstrated that Iran was actually building a nuclear weapon. And the other was that if there was any a high casualty incident that could be tied to Iran in Iraq. So does that mean that if a helicopter gets shot down in Iraq and they can trace the shoulder-fired rocket back to Iran, that we now have a war?
I think that's what the fear is a number of people, is that this is how it could start.
And so so Bush is positioning this, and was this a trial balloon that the administration leaked out and the BBC is reporting, or were they hoping that it wouldn't actually get out?
I suspect they were hoping that it wouldn't get out, but I could be wrong on that. I don't get a clear sense one way or the other.
Yeah, because it seems like if it was a trial balloon, it would have happened in the American press somehow. You would have seen some reference to it in the New York Times, or
right,
I mean, they
exactly.
Historically they have a long history of using the Judy Millers of the world to get these kinds of things out, and you know, God bless her, but she really blew it. You know, it's.
I did ask a question today that will be of interest to you.
Okay.
I asked whether Karl Rove did receive the 2003 Iranian document about.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And what did our good friend?
He didn't even know anything about it at all.
Tony Snow knew nothing about it.
Nothing whatsoever.
Interesting. Did he promise to look into it?
He did.
Interesting. That's great, Victoria Jones. 57 minutes past the hour. Thanks, Victoria.
Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
Well, they say they're all in favor of the troops. Yes, let's support the troops. These young men and women, and some of them even a little older men and women, who are defending our country, putting their lives on the line. That's the administration line, right? Welcome back to the program, by the way. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour. Past the hour of 2 o'clock on the East Coast, past the hour of 11 on the West Coast. So the Bush administration, always willing to do a photo op with the troops. Well, except for this guy who had his legs blown off, and he told the Bush administration that he was going to show up in a pair of shorts, which, of course, would show the fact that he was a double amputee, and they said, oh, you can't do that. This guy, his name was David Thomas, Purple Heart. He says, are you telling me I can't go to the ceremony because I'm an amputee? I'm not ashamed of what I did, and y'all shouldn't be neither. But when the guest list came out for the ceremony, his name wasn't on it. No part of it. So anyhow, we know that it's all about photo ops for the Bush administration. But now here, Dana Priest and Ann Hall over at the Washington Post, they snuck into the Veterans Administration hospital or series of facilities. And what they have discovered is something that you read this article in the Washington Post, and it's like something out of I was going to say a Russian gulag. Obviously, it's not that bad, but this is really grim stuff. They said that what was once the crown jewel of military medicine, this from the Washington Post, has become something else entirely, a holding ground for physically and psychologically damaged outpatients. Now, this was over a four-month period. They were sneaking in and out of these hospitals. The hospital didn't know. They said they wanted to get past the very well-oiled public relations machine. And here, this is a summary from the Washington Post piece that the Center for American Progress put together at thinkprogress.org, of some of the points in this article in the Washington Post by Ann Hall and Dana Priest. The legions of injured soldiers housed at the facilities, quote, take up every available bed on post and spill into dozens of nearby hotels and apartments leased by the Army, end quote. Building 18, quote, has been plagued with mold, leaky plumbing, and a broken elevator, end quote. Quote, the wounded manage other wounded. Soldiers dealing with psychological disorders of their own have been put in charge of others at risk of suicide. Now here's another quote from the Washington Post piece. Disengaged clerks, unqualified platoon sergeants, and overworked case managers fumble with simple needs. On the news hour last night with Jim Lehrer, Dana Priest of the Washington Post said, we know that the American people support the troops, no matter what they think of this war. And so when we started hearing these stories of neglect and in some cases indifference, it was unbelievable. But, hey, you know, if they can line up a photo op, and of course over at Fox News, it's the teachers union. You know, they're the biggest threat to us. Whatever happened to caring for our own? Whatever happened to the idea, the all-American idea of we're all in this together? The traditional liberal notion that came out of the Enlightenment, that came out of Jean-Jacques Rousseau and arguably John Locke and the writings of Jefferson and Madison and Jay and even, you know, the George Washington, although most of his stuff was ghostwritten by James Madison, Ben Franklin, that we're a community of people. Franklin, he's starting the first public library, starting the first public fire department. Public education in this country, the idea that, you know, Thomas Jefferson, he didn't even want it on his tombstone that he was president of the United States for two terms. He thought it was more important that he was president of the University of Virginia, a free college that anybody could go to if they had the academic wherewithal. Well, yeah, any white guy back then. I'll give you that. As our caller said in the last hour, you know, America has has to face its dark side. And yet, that ideal was there. And we have a long history now, a 230-year history of improving step by step by step, getting better and better, saying, okay, you know, habeas corpus in 1215 on the field in Runnymede, King John the First was challenged by the feudal lords, and they said, you will sign the Magna Carta. And you will grant the rights of habeas corpus to us. Now, back then it was just to the rich guys, but, you know, close enough. It was a beginning. Article 38 of the Magna Carta. In future, no official shall place a man on trial upon his own unsupported statement without producing credible witnesses to the truth of it. In other words, you can't torture somebody until they confess and then put them on trial. And number 39, Article 39 of the Magna Carta, no free man shall be seized or imprisoned or stripped of his rights or possessions or outlawed or exiled or deprived of his standing in any other way, nor will we proceed with force against him or send others to do so, except by the lawful judgment of his equals or the law of the land. 1215. And then in the 1600s, 1627, King Charles I, he threw a couple of knights, five knights in jail in a tax case, and the knights were not part of the privileged class, and the people rose up and they said, we all want those rights that you gave the feudal lords in 1215, which led to the Habeas Corpus Act of 1628. And then 1640, and then 1679, a series of three laws, and these laws have been on the book. They were part of British law. They were part of American law. And here we have now the first president to say, to have an attorney general take the stand and say, well, the Constitution doesn't grant the right of habeas corpus. It prevents you from taking it away unless there's an insurrection or a rebellion, but it doesn't grant it. And you have to say, what? What has happened? You know, frankly, I think what has happened is that we are losing touch in some ways with our history. We're losing touch with we're losing sight of that shining city on the hill that John Kennedy quoted Whitman and then Reagan quoted Kennedy about. Reagan tossed in the shining part, but the city on the hill. Actually, it wasn't Whitman that Kennedy was quoting. Somebody would say, as I recall, a military poet. But in any case, we're losing sight of that. The idea that we have created something extraordinary here in this country. And that we have a sacred obligation, however you define that, to hold it up. And now, again, another assault from the Reich. This from, again, Pink Progress. The top House conservatives have teamed up with right-wing talk host Hugh Hewitt and other bloggers to launch a campaign attacking Congressman John Murtha's new Iraq plan, which would attach measures to a defense spending bill requiring that all U.S. forces sent to Iraq are well-trained and well-equipped. You would think that these guys would not have the audacity? It's not even a strong enough word. John Murtha, you know, a Marine for 37 years, a decorated Marine. John Murtha says, okay, fine, you want to have a war, you got your guys over there. If you're going to send anybody else into war, you have to make sure that they are well-trained and well-equipped so they don't die. They have to have appropriate body armor. They have to have appropriately armored vehicles. Otherwise, you can't send them into a war. That's what Murtha is suggesting. And here we've got Sam Johnson, Tom DeLay, Hugh Hewitt. You got a bunch of right-wing voices out there, and the congressman, Representative Sam Johnson of Texas, attacking Murtha for this. You've got the entire right-wing blogosphere coming out, you know, trying to debating non-binding resolutions aimed at earning political points only destroys morale, stymies success, and emboldens the enemy. Yeah, well, this isn't a non-binding resolution. But they're coming after John Murtha, for saying if you send them into battle, they have to be, you know, it's just, when you wrap this whole thing up, and you step back and you look at the big picture, okay, we're losing our rights, we're sending our soldiers off, and it doesn't matter if they're well-equipped or not, and we're about to invade Iran? 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. And Jeff in Los Altos, California wants to take me on about libertarianism. Hey, Jeff.
Well, yeah. I notice often, Tom, and I listen to you all the time, about when you mention republicanism and libertarianism, you often do it in the same sentence. Mm-hmm. And as a
my simple take is that libertarians are Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid.
Well, that may be true, but here's an interesting point. Take Bob Barr, for example. He was mentioned in the last hour.
Sure.
I don't know if you noticed, but he's actually become a libertarian. He's actually completely left the Republican Party. And mind you, that's something that's made a lot of libertarians kind of uncomfortable in a way, because he's I think still a fairly unapologetic drug warrior, but you know, we're happy to have anybody of influence in our party, and he's pretty much renounced everything the Republicans are about, and for good reason, because these guys, and this is just my opinion, and I can, you know, we can talk about any number of issues, but these guys, Republicans, they simply use the rhetoric of libertarianism, the rhetoric of liberty, and really are just advancing corporate fascism and corporatism. For example, take privatization. You know, this is sort of presented as sort of the compromise between, you know, paring down government. They say, well, we're not going to pare it down, but we're going to allow private companies to take over the functions of government. To me, that's not libertarianism at all. That's simply just increasing the ties between corporations and government, increasing the power of corporations over.
The way that a true libertarian would take that is government should not be collecting the taxes in the first place to be paying the private contractors to do the job. Government should just get out of the way. And if people don't, you know, if people can't eat, you know, food stamps, screw them. If people want Social Security, what, are you kidding? Come on, get with the program here.
But here's the problem. Look, there's a lesser of two evils argument here, and I think whatever the downside of, you know, quote-unquote getting the government out of the way, which, by the way, I like the idea of, the worst alternative is having government. Here's the worst alternative: having government and corporations increase their ties, because only makes
Jeff, I'll
more powerful.
I'll give you that. I'll give you that. I don't disagree with you that the Republican Party has lost its way big time. I mean, the Republican Party started in June of 1856 in Jackson, Michigan, as a reform party originally. I mean, they were originally a progressive reform party. That's essentially what Lincoln was. You know, he was a relatively progressive reformer. And in the 1880s, the Republican Party totally lost their way and became, you know, sold out to the robber barons, and they've been married to the dark side ever since. But these basic memes that come out of objectivism and Ayn Rand, that then were reinvented as libertarianism, and that are now showing up with the Grover Norquist bunch in the Republican Party. Things like taxation is theft. If you don't pay your taxes, guys with guns are going to show up at your house. There's something, therefore, intrinsically wrong with that. That the original intent of the Constitution and the founders was that government would play virtually no role in our lives. These simply are not true.
Well, here's the way I put it. This is as a guy, I'm a registered libertarian, I voted Democrat down the line this last election. Every D I could see I voted for. And, you know, the first reason, of course, is I'm absolutely disgusted with what the Republican Party's turned into. I think there's absolutely not one whit of libertarianism left in that party. The other part is I think, you know, it's sort of another lesser of two evils argument for me. What's worse, is it social welfare or corporate welfare? And obviously I've made my choice. You know,
You think corporate welfare is worse, but why stay with the Libertarian Party? The Libertarian Party is against social welfare as well. You know, the basic mantra of the Libertarians is social contract. I never signed those stinking social contracts. Let me just finish the sentence and then I'll give it to you. The fact of the matter is by being born into this country, you signed a social contract. We all did collectively. I would suggest that you leave the Libertarian Party and take your pro-liberty notions, you know, the good ones, and I'm sure that there's many of them there, Jeff, into the Democratic Party. Let's infiltrate the Democratic Party and take it over.
Well, there may be a good argument there, and I've certainly moved to more to the left over the years, and there's been a lot of good reasons for that. I mean, I guess what I wanted to say is that the reason why I think social welfare is less of an evil is, frankly, you know, it's a pretty much a basic thing. I'd like to, you know,
I think it's a good.
It prevents riots. Let's put it that
way.
No,
it's a good, Jeff. A chain is only as strong as its weakest link. Humans have always been about community. We start, you know, from family to clan to tribe to neighborhood to state. We have always been about community. And that's what libertarians turn their back on. Libertarians are anti-community.
Community doesn't just come from government. And that's the part I disagree about.
Community creates government.
Well, and
libertarians deny that.
And, well, government is more than just, just there is such a thing as, there's government, there's invisible government.
Well, there's government. I mean, when Ayn Rand fled Russia, she had some legitimate gripes with the Soviet Union as government. And you can get it. And a lot of libertarians, when they talk about government, it's like it's an it. In the United States, the government is us. And if enough of us show up and participate and take it back, it will once again become us. And that's what we need to work on, rather than saying, oh, we need smaller government or less government or let's get rid of government, in my humble opinion. But, Jeff, you made a good, good defense of it. You should call back some other time. We'll get into a little more of a discussion about what libertarianism is all about, because I think, frankly, because libertarians say, oh, you know, you should be able to smoke dope and prostitution should be legalized, everybody thinks they're liberals. Sorry. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
And welcome back. It's the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 34 minutes past the hour. Jane Hampshire's with us. She's a blogger of FireDogLake.com, the founder, in fact, of the blog FireDogLake.com. And, Jane, before I get to you, I just wanted to make a quick announcement. J.B. Williams was of JB-Williams.com, conservative, was going to be on the program with us in the first hour, and we were going to have a good rough and tumble about immigration policies. And he did show up. Our phones weren't working, so we just wanted to let folks know it wasn't that he was afraid to show up or anything like that. In fact, we'll have him back on soon. Jane Hampshire, welcome.
Hi, good to be here, Tom. We're in the closing hours of the Libby trial here at the courthouse.
You know what I find most fascinating about the way that you've been blogging this trial is the nuance. It's like you're not just blogging the trial, you're blogging the strategies of the trial. And I find that fascinating. For example, the holding up all the photos of the witnesses, except for the two who worked for the CIA, where they held up the CIA logos.
Yeah, it was very interesting. It was actually the most effective graphic of the morning. There's a PowerPoint presentation where they have the four people who told Libby about
Joe Wilson's wife.
Right. Now let's set this up for our listeners. First of all, who's doing the presentation and you know, prosecution, defense, who are the lawyers, and what's their goal with this?
Well, this morning the prosecution began a closing statement, Zeidenberg for Patrick Fitzgerald's team, and he began rounding up all the evidence that was, you know, brought against Libby. And there was a PowerPoint presentation that showed that four individuals had told Libby about Wilson's wife before he claimed to have heard from Tim Russert. And then he spoke with five people before he claimed to have heard from Tim Russert.
Right.
So basically nine people have to have misremembered in exactly the same way for Libby to be telling the truth.
Interesting. Interesting. Now, a little earlier, I had been speaking with Victoria Jones over at the Talk Radio News Service, and she said that each one of those nine people, all of the witnesses against Libby, in one way or another, had had their testimony impeached. I mean, it's almost as if I was to say, Jane, what were you talking about on the afternoon of September 23rd, 2006? I mean, odds are there's no way you'd remember. She was of the opinion that there actually is a possibility there may be an acquittal here. Do you think that that's the case?
Hope springs eternal, Tom.
You mean for a prosecution, for a successful prosecution?
Well, for someone who wants to say that all nine people misremembered, yeah, it's the defense's job to go up there and try and impeach their testimony. The question is, how successfully did they do it?
Sure.
It's an awful lot of evidence against Scooter Libby. Yeah. They seem to be focusing on Tim Russert and trying to impeach his testimony because that's the real damaging charge. And that's central to the whole thing. If Russert's telling the truth, then all the rest of it is academic.
And he's the one who was absolutely unambiguous, too. I mean, he was just like, hey, this is how it is.
He was unambiguous, and when the prosecution was presenting their case, they said during Libby's testimony, he mentioned 36 times, no, that couldn't be true because I didn't remember hearing it until I talked to Tim Russert.
Right.
So his whole story depends on Russert, and right. So they're doing their best to knock a hole in his testimony. But the interesting thing that's happening today is that it's very apparent that all roads lead to Dick Cheney. You know, Scooter's testimony for Shooter.
Yes, Scooter on behalf of the shooter. And it's true, and which raises the question, and you and I have talked about this before, but it's worth revisiting. Why did Patrick Fitzgerald not list Dick Cheney as an unindicted co-conspirator? Or for that matter, why didn't he use the RICO statutes, for example, or some other law, you know, conspiracy law, as opposed to simply perjury?
Well, he was charged with investigating IP, identity protection and espionage. And if you look closely at the charges he brought against Libby, he could have brought a lot more. Libby told a lot more lies. But what he got were the holes he needed to fill in order to bring espionage. So I think he's being very careful, very specific, and I think that he needs Libby to get to Cheney, because as long as Libby's acting as a firewall to Cheney, he's a very cautious prosecutor. He's not the out-of-control prosecutor that people try and paint him as.
Right.
He's very careful, he's very methodical, and I think he needs Libby before he can get to Cheney.
Now, if Libby is successfully prosecuted, if he's convicted, and then you go into the sentencing phase, that's typically the time when somebody who has been convicted will say, hey, you want to make a deal? I mean, it's one of those times when they'll say, hey, you want to make a deal.
Well, if we were talking about John Gotti or Sammy the Bull Gravano, that would be the time.
Right. But in the case of...
Fortunately, you've got the press in the form of the Washington Post, the David Broders of the world, saying, poor Scooter Libby, it's just a little perjury. What's a little perjury between friends?
Right.
Setting the table for a pardon. John Gotti didn't have the ability to pardon Sammy the Bull.
Right. So do you think that the broad consensus is that because Bush will, in all probability, pardon Libby when he leaves office, and Libby can probably drag an appeal out long enough that he'll never go to jail before Bush leaves office, that there's no way that Libby's going to roll over on Cheney?
I think that Democrats, progressives, journalists of all kinds need to be screaming bloody murder at the fact that this might happen. It's not okay. It's not okay that journalistic institutions like the Washington Post are using their influence in order to mislead people about what this trial is about and set the table for that.
Right.
But, you know, saying that because Fitzgerald, David Broder said, because Fitzgerald didn't bring espionage identity protection, that nobody committed those crimes, that's ridiculous. That's like saying Al Capone never did anything but tax evasion.
Right.
We live in a country where you have to be able to prove your case. Yeah. And if people are lying to you, you can't prove it. Yes. And the fact that these people are going out there and saying this and that this is being accepted as reasonable journalistic practice is absurd. Bush is not going to, you know, if there's enough heat, if there's enough slack, if there's enough consequences, it's going to make it very difficult for George Bush to pardon Scooter Libby, even on his way out the door.
Yeah. Do you think do you get the sense that Fitzgerald is inclined to move up the food chain here, or is he just doing, you know, this one thing that he was commissioned to do and that's going to be the end of it?
I think he has it in him. I think he wants to. I think it's in his DNA to go to the source of the crime, and it's absolutely apparent that he knows that that's Dick Cheney. Whether he has the ability to do it, whether it will be thwarted, like the Bush administration has thwarted so many other things by firing the U.S. attorneys who are pursuing Duke Cunningham or whatever else they're doing as part of their criminal conspiracy. Yeah. I think they'll continue to do it, and if they can thwart him, they will. But I don't think he's going to take it lying down.
I think we're getting close to the point where it's time to bring the RICO statutes against the Republican Party. I mean, you know, or at least the Bush administration and their collusion. For example, firing all these prosecutors who are looking into the crimes of the Bush administration and replacing them with political hacks. It's just it's over the top. Anyhow, Jane, just to wrap this up, what's happening next is the final arguments are being made, and then it goes to the jury, and then it could be what, a couple of days?
It could be a couple of days or a week. Yeah. I don't know anything about, you know, this jury. They're a very smart jury. Mm-hmm. Ted Wells is trying to a low-information jury, and I don't think that that's what this jury is. I actually think that there's a good chance they might come back fairly quickly.
Yeah, interesting. Jane Hampshire, FiredogLake.com, the website. Some great blogging on the Libby trial. She's there live. Jane, thanks so much for being here with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Great talking with you today. Bye. I appreciate it. It's 42 minutes past the hour. And, indeed it is. 1-866-303-2270 is our telephone number. And Aldous in Madison, Wisconsin, you've got a constitutional rights event you wanted to plug?
Well, absolutely. I mean, as you know, in 1789, March 4th was the date that it went into effect there, the Constitution. And so what we've done is we've taken that wonderful pun, March 4th, as the name of our event.
That's great.
Specifically, We the People March 4th, and that's the date we're going to do it on.
Uh-huh. That's right. And in Madison, where, or is this nationwide?
Oh, it's nationwide. Right now we've got at least 13 events around the country on the map, and with more to come. We've got them in Wichita. There's going to be a cocktail party in Wichita. There's going to be a small festival in Seattle. There's costume processions in Salt Lake City, Palm Springs, Tacoma.
That's great. Is there a website for this, Aldous?
Absolutely. It's wethepeoplemarch4th.org, and there's a trick to it. It's wethepeoplemarch, the way you expect to spell it, then the number 4 and the letter T, and letters TH. So wethepeoplemarch4th.org.
Great. Thank you very much, Aldous, and good luck and best wishes on it. It's great. It's just so great to hear people doing things. Russell in Queen Valley, Arizona. Hey, Russell. Listening
to
KPHF.
How are you doing, Tom?
I'm fine. What's up?
Me too. If I was any better, I'd be two people.
There you go. If I was any better, it'd be illegal, right?
Yeah, there you go.
What's up?
I really am concerned that if Bush doesn't get impeached and pays for this, it's not so much him. It will be our first Caesar, and the Republic will be gone. If any executive in the future thinks that there's no consequence, then we're back to being dependent on a good king or a bad king.
This is the terrible precedent that Jerry Ford set. And we talked about this in the program for a couple of days around the time that Jerry Ford died.
Right.
Not in the context of speaking ill of the dead, but just kind of revisiting the events of his presidency. And his pardoning Richard Nixon deprived this nation of an opportunity to know what the crimes were that Nixon committed, and for him to be held accountable for them, even if he never went to jail. I mean, this wasn't about vengeance.
Exactly.
It was about saying this will not be allowed to happen again. It's establishing a precedent, and the precedent that Jerry Ford set was, in my opinion, one that's very frankly destructive for American
democracy. It is, and if the Democratic, but not the Democratic. This is not political. This is not party. This is right and wrong.
That's right.
And if we let this go without consequences, I fear that we're going to be dependent on whether it's a good president or bad president, you know, like before 1066,
yeah.
Magna Carta.
Yeah.
It will be dependent on the personality of the president. We can't allow that.
Yeah, 1066 was the Battle of Hastings. 1215 was the Magna Carta. But close enough. Close enough.
I'm 64.
That's all right. Russell, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank
I appreciate
you,
it. Yeah, good to hear from you. And it really is that. I mean, it's and keep in mind, Richard Nixon resigned because articles of impeachment had been drawn up. John Conyers was primarily instrumental in pulling them together in the House anyway. And he realized he was going to be impeached because he actually did the crime. And maybe we could see history repeat itself. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Taking my country back. Oh, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't lie. You've been treating my scars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese.
Billions!
You blew the budget and you botched Iraq.
I'm taking my country back, my friends. It's incumbent upon us all. We all have to do it. It's a collective effort, taking our country back. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jeff in Denver, Colorado on the line. Hey, listening on KKZN. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Well, first of all, about the education thing, I think we can call our philosophy nowadays in this country is leave no child of mind.
Tragically, yeah.
What I'm calling about today is H.R. 811, Rush Holt's voting reform bill.
Yeah.
And there's a big problem with it. Unfortunately, we've got a conflict here where none of the voting advocates seem to be supporting it, and I'm one who does not support it.
Right.
In its present form, and whereas Move On and People for the American Way and Common Cause are telling their members to vote for it, to write about it, support it.
Right.
But it's got some real fatal flaws, and it can be... and so I want people to, know that just a few simple changes can make it a good bill, but right now it can probably do more damage than it would help. And
I agree with you, Jeff. How do we make these changes, though?
Well, the one main change, we tell Rush Holt and the other sponsors that it needs to call for paper ballots that are the official record of the election. Right now it calls for a paper trail. It is very different than paper ballots.
Okay.
And those paper ballots must be the item that is counted.
Right.
The paper trail is next to worthless. Called VVPAT.
Right. It's like a placebo ballot. The other concern that I have is just the whole idea of privatizing the vote.
Yes.
And Rush Holt's bill, to the best of my knowledge, doesn't address that. I had him on this program almost 4 years ago when he first introduced this piece of legislation. And I said, Congressman Holt, why, if the vote is the way that we administer our government, which administers the commons, if the vote is the ultimate common of the commons, it's the ultimate thing that we all collectively own, and we all agree that it would be a terrible thing to sell Yellowstone to Disney, to privatize other parts of the commons, why privatize the vote? And there was a long pause, and he said, you've got a good point. And I was hoping, that something would come of that.
Well, if you really want to be frightened in that regard, just go to Wikipedia and look up Diebold voting. I think it's Diebold election systems, but make sure it's that part. And look at the history of one of the people as main programmers who is convicted of felony fraud multiple times.
Right, and identity theft and things like that.
Yeah, but for programming back doors into ATMs.
Right.
And these are the people who are creating our voting systems.
Yeah.
And, if you study this issue on and on. But anyway, right now, we need to contact Rush Holt immediately and say we want paper ballots and we want those ballots to be the thing that are counted.
The paper ballots are the official record of the election. That's the key to making Rush Holt's bill work.
Yeah, because we've got these paper trails, like in Ohio, Cuyahoga County hired Election Science Institute to do a study of whether the VVPATs were accurate. And they found that over 10% were problematic. So these are the things that are supposed to back us up. And then, can you imagine counting a cash register tape and looking at each item? Yeah, these things are almost impossible to audit.
Yeah.
And they're printed on thermal paper. They smudge. They don't print right. They jam up in the printers.
Right.
But
yeah, make the paper ballot the official record, and then we can argue about how we're going to look at the paper ballot, as time goes on. But
some of us are working on those systems right now, and we'll have some new proposals out very soon.
Good. Well, good on you, Jeff. Thanks.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to us on KKZN, and thank you for the great work that you've been doing for years and years, actually. Jeff has been a regular caller on the program. Ruth in Tacoma, Washington, listening on KPTK. Hey, Ruth, what's up?
Well, I was just thinking to myself, wouldn't it be better if Scooter Libby remained an unimpeachable source, that it was Cheney who first revealed the CIA identity to him? In both the grand jury and in this trial, no one has challenged that Cheney told him first. He just forgot it and then remembered it.
Right. Yeah, the problem is Dick Cheney's not on trial yet.
No, right, but it comes down to which is the more valuable truth, that Libby lied or Cheney.
Right, and
he would be an unimpeachable source if he doesn't have perjury and obstruction against him.
Who would be an unimpeachable source?
Libby.
Oh, yeah, well, but right now he could be impeached as being a convicted felon for lying. I mean, there is that small problem.
But if he's not convicted for lying, then he still becomes a good source for indicting Cheney.
Yeah, but I just don't think that Scooter Libby's going to roll over on Cheney. I think he is so confident. These guys, I mean, it's literally like you're dealing with the mob here.
And he's already testified. It's already a matter of record that Cheney was his first source of the information when he encouraged him to give it to the press.
Yeah, but I don't think okay. And arguably that in and of itself should be enough to at least indict Cheney. Yeah, good point, Ruth. Okay, I'll go along with that. You're right. Bill in Taos, New Mexico, listening on KVOT. Hey, Bill.
Hi, Tom. I was wondering, back on this posse comitatus that you talked about in the first hour.
Yeah.
I don't know how old you are, but were you around in 67?
I was alive in 67.
You were alive.
I was 16 years old in 67. Why?
I was barely alive. I was in Fort Benning in 67.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the troops that are on standby, and the elements of the 101st Airborne were sent into Detroit, and they shot up the town pretty good
during the riots.
Yeah,
yeah.
And
and you had the Kent State, you had the National Guard.
That was National Guard, but the 101st Airborne is federal.
Yeah.
And how do we explain that, given the Posse Comitatus Act?
I don't know. I would say either. Let's see. LBJ was president then.
Yeah.
Either LBJ just massively violated the law and was never held to account for it, or, you know, there's something that I'm missing and that you're missing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Interesting question, Bill. It's very interesting. Maybe I'm guessing one of our listeners will know and will let us know. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you, and thanks for listening to the program and the station there. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up on tomorrow's program, No Child Left Behind is up for reauthorization. I'll be challenging conservative Keith Lockwich, who says that only the free market can save our public schools. Yeah, right. Hey, remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.